You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to the most epic show on earth. I am just one of your hosts here, Matthew Rushing on the 602 Club. And with me, John Mills. We keep you alive to serve this show. Podcast well and live.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. It's a tough podcast to be on, but when the ultimate reward is not being chained to the oar when the podcast catches on fire and sinks, which is no small feat for a ship to do. I really gotta say this. I'm gonna give it my old college try here for you.
Well, if we haven't sunk by episode 506, I think we're good. So.
Okay, fair. That's fair.
Well, I'm so excited tonight because we're going to be diving into the epic of William Wyler's Ben-Hur. But before we dive in, I want to thank everybody for listening. We really do appreciate it. Of course, you can find us all over social media under the 602 Club. But we're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. You can find us online with the entire network at Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. We're online with our brand new website as well as tfm.fan. So check that out. And if you love the show, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You'll get the episodes as soon as they drop. And of course, you can help out the show by giving us a star rating review over on Apple Podcasts, star ratings on Spotify, places like that. And if you like the show, and you know other people who like movie podcasts, tell them about us. Let them know that they should listen. We would really appreciate that. So, John, Ben-Hur is an absolutely epic film. In the vein of the Ten Commandments, it's basically what they were going for. It's what MGM wants at this point. But as epic as it is, you've never seen it, my friend.
And amazingly.
So I wanted to kind of just talk about that a little bit. You know, what is it about the film that just is one of those things you just hadn't been able to get around to? And I do kind of want your general impressions, even just kind of coming into the movie and you just, what was in your mind as, you know, you're turning on Ben-Hur here for the first time to actually watch it?
Well, I remember when I was a kid, very young, youngish, I was over at a family friend's house and, you know, for whatever reason, I was hanging out with their kid when our parents were off, you know, having cigarettes and, well, my mom didn't smoke, so my dad would have been the one smoking. Anyway, they're off, after dinner, talking, chatting, like people did in the days before Facebook and stuff like that. And I remember Ben-Hur came on TV and I don't remember what time of year it was or whatever. And I remember the scene of him getting the water from Jesus. I remember seeing it on the TV. I wasn't really paying attention. And I remember when they showed up at one point that I think I asked my dad if Ben-Hur was another name for Jesus, because I was, I'm a kid watching TV. I was like, so was that, because I didn't know that the title character was, Charlton Heston sort of thing. It's like very foggy as a kid. But why didn't I ever get around to it is honestly, it's one of those things where like, it's got such an outsized reputation and you're always like, you know what, if I'm going to see that, I should see it on the big screen. That becomes excuse number one. Excuse number two, I'm coming up in the 90s and stuff like that. And, there's not enough time really, you're watching other stuff, you're hanging out with your friends and then, you get married and a job and everything like it. It's just life gets in the way eventually. And then eventually you're like, I how can I watch 3.5 hours uninterrupted? That's impossible. And now, granted, this has an intermission and an overture and everything like that, but I don't know that going in. You know, just not functioning in my brain. So I just had never gotten around to it. And the whole reason I wound up seeing it, ironically, is because I go to the movies with my kid and Flashback Cinema is like, see Ben-Hur on the big screen. And I was like, oh, here's my chance. I can go see Ben-Hur on the big screen. And then womp womp, I get too busy. I can't see Ben-Hur on the big screen. So I wound up just having to watch it at home. There you go.
What I'm really fascinated about this. Obviously, everybody knows certain things about Ben-Hur. Just you're enough of a cinephile to have a thought process about what this movie is and what it's going to entail. And so going into it, what are the things that you did know about it? And what were you kind of expecting the movie to be like?
I knew about the chariot race. I knew, obviously, I had that very foggy memory as a very young kid of him meeting Jesus and getting the water. And I remember that The Simpsons referred to it in the film festival episode that was a crossover with The Critic, where in the film A Burns for All Seasons about Mr. Burns' life, he shows up and he's the one that gives water to Charlton Heston. And he goes, you truly are the king of kings. Drink up, Judah Ben-Hur. Excellent. That is literally all I knew about the movie. That's funny. It. I did not, like, there was a lot that took me by surprise with this movie where I was like, oh, wow. Like, if I had the time, I think it would be really interesting to have a double feature with the Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it would take you a week to get through, but, you know, you could do it. But especially because Charlton Heston being the lead in both of them is just so weird. Like, it's so wild. Like, it's like, this is his thing. You know, the sword and sandal epic, you're going to go to Chuck Heston. You know, and it's like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because this is one of those movies where I was just really thankful that, you know, my parents didn't let me watch a lot of new things. And so I just grew up with movies like Ben-Hur, The Ten Commandments, all of these movies from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and, you know, from biblical epics to westerns to the, you know, the romantic comedies with like the Audrey Hepburns or the Kate Hepburns and Cary Grants of the world. And so, yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to even remember a time where I haven't seen Ben-Hur and didn't know what it was. And yet this is also a movie that I haven't seen in a long time. Like you said too, I mean, this is longer than most of the extended cuts of Lord of the Rings, except for Return of the King.
Yeah.
And so it is a big time commitment to sit down and to watch this movie. What I thought was really interesting, though, is just like going in and doing some research, because I'd never really done that, and watched some of the documentaries on the Blu-ray with the 4K edition that I got. I had no idea that MGM was in such a terrible place. You know, it's late 1950s, you know, 57 through 59. This movie comes out in 59. And they're really struggling. They think they might go under. And their thought is go bigger and go longer. And because, you know, do what TV can't. And so they gamble on the biblical epic and the Ten Commandments. And I mean, I don't know. Coming into this, John, and, you know, with knowing that this movie is like 3.5 hours and everything, would that have been your choice as a studio executive back in the late 50s? Be like, dude, let's make one of the longest movies possible so that people will get back to the theaters and it'll save our studio.
You know, the thing is, you laugh, and I'm tempted to laugh with you, but that's the kind of bold thing, like, you got to try. If you seriously, you might go under with your next film. You know, yeah. Oh my gosh, you might not make it out of this decade. Why wouldn't you push all your chips in? The go small to save the studio thinking is exactly why we have audiences that aren't thrilled with,
yeah, agreed,
with things. And they also mistake nowadays go big to mean 17 rounds of reshoots, restructurings based on what the board thinks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
This is, and I'll take Ben-Hur as an example, or the Ten Commandments or something like that. You're right. This is a huge gamble, but it's a gamble based on the idea that you're going to give people, it's a showman's gamble. I'm going to give you something you can't get anywhere else. This is the only way you're going to get this experience. It's what attracts us to the carnival. It's what attracts us to the amusement park. It's what attracts us to musicals or, you know, live theater, is the idea that I cannot have this experience somewhere else. It's experience based. And so I think that it, to me, it makes perfect sense. If I'd been in that meeting and somebody's like, you know what? Screw it. We're going to make a giant biblical epic. We're going to try to replicate what they did with the Ten Commandments, and we are going to come at it large, and we are going to make this happen. I'd have been the guy sitting there going, you know, to borrow a sentiment from Rick and Morty, USOB, I'm in. Like, I'm totally down with that, because this is, it's artistic thinking too. And I think that it's the only way you're gonna make it. Like, playing it too conservatively, that would have cost MGM everything. And honestly, and the thing is, again, it's not just about spending, because I think that the trouble you're gonna find, and this is, I took, you know, sort of like a roundabout swipe before, but what happens with superhero movies, they start second guessing themselves, and they start trying to play it too close to the chest. They start trying to keep it close and bet only on what they think will absolutely work. So even though your budget is $1 billion to make your stupid movie, you're still playing it conservatively. You're playing from a place of fear.
Yeah.
And yes, boom, there you go.
I think you said that really well. Don't let that go to your head or anything. But I think as you were speaking, I was thinking, like, this is why Christopher Nolan is a draw for the cinema. Because you know going into one of his movies that he's going to do something that you can't just see on television, right? And I think, you know, that's one of the things where television can give you Game of Thrones, so it feels like you're watching a movie every week on television. And you know, when you got to the end of those seasons and the end of the series where, you know, each episode is 120 minutes, it feels like, and some of them are close to almost 2 hours, and so it they're putting the time, the money, and the budget in just as they would on the big screen. It does kind of make sense that this would be the choice. Like, if we want people to have a reason to come back into the theater, we have to do the thing you can't do on, you know, serial procedurals on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think of what's popular back in like 59, but it's like, you can't see this on Mr. Ed, you know?
Right.
Or Leave It to Beaver. So
3.5 hour Leave It to Beaver movie. Now, see,
should we tell Dad? No, he'll holler at us and stuff.
Somebody feed that to an LLM, right? Go to ChatGPT and tell it to write a script for a 3.5 hour long Leave It to Beaver movie. I want to see what you do. Send it to Matt at the end of that.
I mean, but at the same time, what's really interesting, because you brought up the idea of, and it, I don't want to talk necessarily about Chuck Heston just yet. We're close, so that's why I can call him that. But this movie almost gets made with different actors, and they look at, like, Paul Newman. He just, like, literally turns down the role because he didn't want to wear the tunic. You know, Marlon Brando actually almost ends up making this movie. Rock Hudson. Kirk Douglas. Like, I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned the idea of, you know, Heston being in the other major biblical epic of the time, you know, just a few years prior with the Ten Commandments. Could you see any of these other guys doing this role in a way that, you know, when we're talking about a studio in trouble, this is the guy you want to lead this film?
Yeah. Ah, gosh. I mean, the thing is, I hadn't thought, like, the thing is, what I'm really chewing on right here is I got to know, I don't know if you know, because when you mentioned Kirk Douglas's name, Spartacus comes out in 1960, doesn't it? The year after?
It's very close.
Yeah, and it's very close. Yeah. So now I'm starting to think, oh, wait, did he wind up accepting Spartacus because he sees Ben-Hur and he's like, oh, nuts, I really screwed that one up. Because think about that, is Spartacus with Chuck Heston instead of Kirk Douglas. I think actually that all that stuff shakes out the way it should, specifically because I can't see either actor in either of those roles. I honestly can't. Like, I can't see Kirk Douglas in here. I can't see Chuck Heston in Spartacus. They're the type of role that they are is different. And in terms of Marlon Brando, and forgive me because I will absolutely murder names throughout the whole thing. But Ben-Hur's Roman friend.
Missala. Yeah.
Missala. Yes.
Yeah.
Like Stephen Boyd as Missala. I could see Brando there. I could see Brando there. I can't see him as Judah Ben-Hur, though. I could have seen him maybe as Jack Hawkins, Quintus Arias, Jack Hawkins' role. I could see him there. But no, I wouldn't. I would not have wanted to see Brando in the lead here. Like, sorry, I'm really going through because it's like when you drop those names, I'm like, oh, no, honestly, they really did do one of the best things they could have done. Heston's a very big performer. I don't mean just physically, but his style is, you know, this is he's the only guy that could have delivered the line, get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape, and you don't giggle. Because you're like, he has that weight, that theatrical weight that works in an epic like this. It conveys very theatrically.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Yeah, I mean, I think he has gravitas as big as Cinescope.
Yeah. You know? Well put.
And yeah. So... I really like the way you were kind of going through them, though, because and the fascinating thing is that Douglas is actually the one who's interested in this movie, but they go with Heston instead. And then, yes, you're right. Spartacus comes out in 60. So I think Kirk Douglas was like, I want to do a massive epic. And so Spartacus, they give him that role. And I 100% agree. I just think that the type of roles that they are totally different. And part of that, I think it's okay to just, you know, we'll talk about the rest of the cast later, but, you know, Charlton Heston is such an integral part to this movie actually just working, right? And I think you began to kind of talk about some of the ways in which that's key for this. But what else is it that Heston is able to bring to this role that nobody else could and actually makes this movie work in a way where you're glued to the screen for 3.5 hours because of his performance, you know, like because he's mm-hmm. in almost every single scene. There's almost no scene where he's not the main character in it.
Yeah. Heston is a really interesting screen actor because you don't get tired of him being on screen. There are actors.
That's a great way to put it.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially with a film like this. I've seen plenty of sword and sandal epics and old movies where you're like, oh, okay, this guy's doing his thing. Okay, whatever. I think that Heston's a very earnest actor. And so I'm willing to believe, again, I think it gets back to theater. This is a movie, this is the type of movie that's very rooted in, it feels like a play. And those are two, you know, it's not the small scale, intimate acting of The Godfather. This is a big movie that demands big emotions. So when Heston is angry, he's angry. And when he is sad, he's really sad. And it's just, and he is able to convey that physically and emotionally. I mean, the thing is, you really have to make a decision when you watch a movie like this to put yourself in the mindset of what genre you're in. And I think, you know, even to flash forward, there were so many things, and I know I'm going a little, you know, off to the side here, but that type of acting, Heston's type of acting, you see it evoked in later movies on purpose, and modern audiences don't get it. And they reject it because they're not understanding what's going on anymore. And Heston is not a method actor. He's a screen actor. It's just a different way of doing it. What I think is really interesting is Heston is somehow the perfect complement for the way that Wyler and he worked with, he worked on Citizen Kane.
Cinematographer?
Yeah, I think so.
Robert L.
Yeah, Surtees. Yeah.
You know, Surtees, yeah.
Yeah, but he, like, the photography in this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's insane the fact that he, you know, that the film is able to, I guess Surtees didn't work on, what did he work on? But the thing is, you look at his filmography and it's like, there's so much stuff where it's like, it makes sense that he worked on Ben-Hur. And it's just the way that it's shot is so, like, Wyler gets something. You know what? Here it is. I know I've rambled for a little bit, but you know what it is? Heston and the other actors keep your attention through long takes.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
It's the long take. That's the magic. That's really the magic. That is what really jumped out at me about the film with this first watch is how long the takes were. And at one point I start breaking down in my brain and I'm like, oh my Lord, they haven't cut yet. I'm so used to the cut that when it's missing, it's so jarring. These people needed to know the scene, not just read a side or have somebody give them a cue. They had to know it. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love that you call that out, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking about the scene, you know, in the galley where, you know, you've got Quintus Arius who's making them go through their paces, right? And literally through the paces of, you know, all the way to ramming speed and back down. And the whole sequence is about the eye contact between Heston and Jack Hawkins and this battle of wills that's happening between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And that all comes, I mean, we talk about Heston being this big performer, and yet all of that is just done through the look on his face, the intensity of his eyes, and the way he's channeling the physical exertion that he's having to do for the role. And it is wonderful acting, right? Like we talk about the size of Heston on screen and the sense of his personality and the way he delivers lines. And yet the smaller moments, I think, are the things that really make this shine, you know? And I think he really, like, between this and the Ten Commandments, I think there was a growth in him in the sense of the way in which he was able to make the smallest facial movement, eye contact, any of that kind of stuff, where it wasn't just about him having to lay into the scene, you know, but to just really bring to life the true emotion of the character. And that's just something, you know, again, with you, when you said this so well earlier too, it's like when you're in the epic, there is a way that you kind of have to bring the largest version of yourself to screen because the story itself is so big, and that's what Heston brings to this role. And I think that's why it continues to work for people, why people can continue to watch it and be pulled in for 3.5 hours, like you said. It's because none of the actors are boring you to death. And that's what happens with too many movies that are made today, where it's like the actor doesn't know how to be alive enough for the genre they're in, you know? And that's why certain movies might not work. And I think Heston, you know, makes this still shine like a diamond, honestly.
I mean, when you think about the fact that Heston is able to make me believe, even though I know in my brain, in every sector of my brain, I know he didn't participate in that chariot race for one moment. Not really. You know, what was there a right. camera in front yeah. of him for the key shots? There sure was. But, you know, I know that there were stuntmen and the pullback and the dummies that they ran over and everything like that. But like, you know, he's able to sell that. And the thing is, I'm glad you mentioned Masala, you know, a couple of times, right? Stephen Boyd, I think, is unfortunately, he's a guy that gets overlooked because I think that his scenes with Heston work really, really well. And what's crazy is that his death scene is so effective, and I didn't expect it to be. When he's sitting there and he's like, he won't let them cut off his legs because he, you know, he won't greet Ben-Hur as half a man. Like it's so wild. And I just,
well, he portrays you know. The pride of this character in a way that makes sense to us as the audience. Right. And I think, the beauty of that is the way that Boyd is able to pick up on, you know, look, this is a biblical epic, you know, and even though it's not a story straight from the Bible, that's what it is. And he's playing that prideful character, right, who's had the fall now. In fact, you know, it's played up at the beginning of the chariot race, right? This absolute pride he has in himself and his horse team, and you know how he is just going to ruin Ben-Hur, and he's going to finally destroy his life once and for all. And then, of course, you know that's not what happens. Yeah. And so he has to have this one prideful moment before he dies.
Yeah.
Of like facing him, quote unquote, man to man.
You know, something else that really is a treat. I know that we're talking about performances and we're talking about I mean, everybody down to, you know, Frank Thring as Pontius Pilate. He's fun, which seems an odd way to sing praise, but of that character in specific, but like Finley Curry, who plays Balthazar, like even a small role like that, he's so good. And I think that, you know, Hugh Griffith playing Sheik.
The Sheik, yeah.
Look, set everything else aside. I know what we could come at that role for. I know, you know, all of that type of stuff. He plays such a fun character. He's the low-key one. And seeing him playing a character who will beat the guy that whips his horses. You don't mistreat his horses. Like, it's fun.
Yeah,
and the scene that he has with Stephen Boyd to goad him into betting everything, you know, like the way he manipulates him is so beautifully done. Beautifully done.
A little bit of episode one in there too.
Oh, there certainly is. Oh, okay. You know what? You want to tear that Band-Aid off? Okay. One hell of a moment for me. Was I always understood the pod race. I was like, yeah, you know, it's like NASCAR sort of thing. George Lucas loves racing. Okay, we're doing the three loops and everything. I remember, you know, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, three. I was so used to movies doing one lap and the race is over sort of thing. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Seeing this film and having the pod race in my brain and go, oh my gosh, if I had seen this before episode one, I would have gotten the gag. George Lucas made a space chariot race that is basically this movie. And I'm like it's crazy to me that I did not see that called out enough by critics or viewers at the time who saw the film. But it's literally like Lucas watched the chariot race here a few times and went, I want to make that. Everybody gets a chariot. I mean, for Pete's sake, Masala is Sebulba.
Absolutely.
You know, and the old, and he's causing everybody to crash. And the only thing that he, you know, it's the only trick that he has. Of course, he's won a ton of times. He's murdering people. You know,
yeah, like, exactly.
Makes sense to me. And it's crazy because there is so much, and the, even the color palette that's used is, and I mean, let's take a moment. Let's take a moment and pine away for yet another old film you can watch in CinemaScope with Technicolor, and you're like, wow, they really used to love color in film, didn't they? They really loved having not this flat, washed out, you know, gray palette sort of thing. It's like, it's just beautiful. But yeah, I did it on purpose, obviously. The big, no, but like even here, the big parade they have when he goes and you know, he gets presented the emperor by Quintus Arius and everything like that. I'm sitting
there,
and I'm like, oh, it's the parade on Naboo. What the hell, man? Like, if I had seen this movie before episode one, I would have actually probably enjoyed episode one even more.
Yeah.
Because as a film fan, how could you, like, oh, wow, look at that.
Well, what I think is interesting is, you know, and this is something I want to ask you about. The movie is called Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ. You know, and it's based off Lew Wallace's book from 1880 by the same title. And this movie just felt like a film about providential help because, you know, we actually do begin with the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem with the wise men coming to him, even though that's not how it happens in scripture. But, you know, they come to him at the same time the shepherds do and whatever. That's what all of our nativities look like. So
you got to condense for time in a film.
Exactly. But I thought I just want to ask you about the idea of having this all be in the background, that Christ is in the background. This is the milieu of Israel that we're dropping the story of Judah Ben-Hur into. And the way in which this movie then incorporates Jesus into the film. But in the same way, too, you're watching this character of Ben-Hur slowly but surely, providentially be taken care of in every single situation that he's in until the moment where, you know, he's able to stand before the cross, right, and have the moment of belief. And that's just something that, especially in the rewatch, I was really struck by that. This movie didn't shy away from any of that in 1959 when, you know, culture is beginning to kind of have a turn. They allow the story to really play out in that way.
Yeah, I think that this is before, you know, I mean, we haven't had Kennedy assassinated. You know, we haven't even had the 1960 presidential election at that point. And I think that audiences at the time more receptive to it, and I think that what's interesting to me about it is I can very easily see a construction of this film that removes all of the biblical aspect to it and actually just pull it out and not have those encounters and just tell the story of Judah Ben-Hur. And if I were to ding the film for one thing and one thing only, it's the fact that that world building aspect it doesn't mesh as well as it could in terms of the way the stories run parallel to each other. And I think that there just could have been a better blending and a better sort of casual acknowledgement of things happening. And also some of the timeline of the film gets a little muddy. And I think part of that is runtime as well. because it's like, okay, well, this starts this year and it goes forward to there. And when he's born, at like, there's even a jokey part of my brain that, you know, it's like, oh, so Judah Ben-Hur was basically born like next door. And I start thinking of Life of Brian by Monty Python. And so, you know, which is, you can't help it. But I think that in terms of including that, it provides, I think, a pretty interesting thing, because it allows the character of Ben-Hur to get to a very different place at the end that he doesn't get to through the course of the revenge epic that he's on. But again, a minor like story point pin I would stick in that is that he gets his conversion moment at the end, but also as an audience, he gets revenge in every way he possibly can before that moment. So his, like, it's one of those things where I might have even looked at it and said, what could he have walked away from and not gotten revenge for and still been okay with it? Basically, like, he leaves he trashes everybody. That's a strong way to say it, but like he overcomes everything and then has that moment at the end. And I think it could have carried more weight had the story been constructed in such a way where his heart is changed and he stops the revenge and says, oh no, actually I know. So I think it sticks a little better there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting you talk about that, because, you know, there's that line earlier in the film where Ben-Hur is told that hate keeps a man alive.
Right.
And I think that one of the things that, when I heard that line, and I know what's coming, it's the thing where I think hate kept him going, but it didn't keep him alive.
Hmm.
And there's something about that whole idea of, you know, in the end, that hate can keep you going. It's definitely good at that. But even when you get the revenge that you desire because of your hate, you're still left empty, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what he is. You know, he's left empty. He doesn't really get, I think, the fulfillment that he desired from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end, what he needed was to be cleansed of the hate and to fall in love, right? Fall in love in the end, obviously, with Jesus, but, you know, and the whole crucifixion scene of, you know, the only way to kind of heal what's happened in this land is for the blood to flow, you know?
Right.
And so I just think there's something really, really beautiful about that in the way that it's portrayed. And I love that it's just not over the top, you know, like it feels like perfectly done for me in that sense. And, you know, at the same time of Ben-Hur being on this journey and Providence taking care of him the whole time, what I love is that too, you know, in the end, he does the right thing and he gets these really interesting, unexpected benefits from it, right? You know, when he saves Quintus Arius, right? He doesn't have to do that. But there's something about him that just can't let this guy die. You know, he does this right thing and you get some unexpected benefits from it. And I think it's one of those things where you can tell, and I would love to go back and read the book, because obviously Wallace knew the Bible very well. And so in a lot of ways, there's a lot of allusions to different Bible stories like Joseph, you know, in Genesis and those type of things, right? You know, what you did for evil, God used for good, you know, kind of thing. And that happens a lot in Ben-Hur's life, which I think is really, really interesting. And so, it's a big part of the movie, and I'm glad that they just didn't let that go. So we talked a little bit about the production of this movie, and they shoot in Italy, so it gives it, you know, a more Mediterranean true feel to it. 1959, and they're pulling off still one of the most amazing things I've ever seen on screen in many different places. And so as for you coming into this for the first time, what did you think about the way in which what they do then holds up?
Gosh, I mean, honestly, there are certain things where I am absolutely floored by how well, I mean, obviously we've already sung praises for the way it's shot. And like, I think of their trek through the desert after he's been enslaved, and it's just, just so beautiful.
Yes.
So yes, it holds up because you just look at even his first meeting with Messala, where they have that really long dialogue, and just the way that the hallway is dark in just the right spots and all of those sorts of things. I think this is one of those things where I would sit somebody down even and just turn the sound off and just say, just look, just watch at how well this is communicating to you without sound. You know, again, I sound like Lucas. It's a visual medium. But what absolutely floored me, I mean, absolutely floored me as somebody who, you know, like you, is a big Star Wars nerd, is how well the effects hold up. Not because I think a matte painting looks real. Not because I think those boats were anything but miniatures, you know, shot with a backdrop sort of thing. But based on the fact that it looks so good. Like, knowing about how the film would have to be run through an optical printer for those things to match up with no juddering at all when they're coming to see the Emperor, and it's just lining up. It's just staying still. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, that's amazing what they pulled off with that shot. And the fact that the lighting is perfectly fine across the shot. Like, it literally bends my brain. So your question about does it hold up? My God, does it hold up? Impressively so. In a way I didn't expect it to hold up. Which, you know, because I always expect, I'm like, oh, you know, it's for its time. There's stuff I would throw this up against some of the computer stuff that they're doing now, where I'm like, okay, make it look like this, guys. This worked fine. Well, why can't you make it work this well, right? Explain it to me. You know, like, I'm five, please. So yeah, I think it really holds up well.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you said about, you know, challenging the people of today, like, make it look like this, you know. And I think that's one of the things that I'm liking about a lot of different places that I'm seeing in film, where they're more trying to utilize every single aspect of filmmaking, right? All the tricks of the trade. Let's use the one that's going to work the best and look the best for the moment that we're in, you know? And so, obviously, Nolan does a great job of that type of thing. You know, you think about how there was zero major computer graphics in a major CGI or VFX in Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing all that optically in camera. You know, I think that's incredible. And, you know, even just seeing that. You know, we haven't seen it yet, but the behind the scenes with Mando and Grogu, where they're utilizing techniques that they used on The Lord of the Rings, right? When they're in that forest, and that we see in the trailer, and they actually created a forest on a soundstage, right? Because there's a reality that you know, makes you feel like you're there, you know? And so the water warfare, I mean, the scale of the production, the sets in Jerusalem that we get, and then, of course, I mean, yeah, the fact that the chariot race still holds up because of the way it's expertly edited.
Oh, so yeah.
There's never a moment where you don't buy what's happening on screen.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. I mean, and that kind of, what's interesting, I wanted to ask you about this, William Wyler and his direction, he's not known for movies like this. The movies he was known for were like Roman Holiday and Miss Miniver and things of that nature, right? He'd never done a production on this magnitude and this scale. And so I wanted to, I know you, obviously you guys talk a lot about directors over off on House Lights. And so how do you think he does as a director to put one of the biggest films of all time on screen and somehow make all this work?
Honestly, it's surprising to me that he didn't direct more like this. And I think probably what it is it speaks to the baseline of what a director does is, and you know, people come at me for this one and all the time, but it is actually my way of singing the praises of a film director, but they're essentially project managers. They got to know everything that's going on. They got to know what's being staged that day. Now, obviously they have a production crew, they have all of that stuff, but they're there and they're also with the actors, making them, you know, inhabit the roles and stuff like that. And honestly, I think it's probably why the performances in this are memorable, is because he worked on smaller films and he obviously honed a way to talk with actors in such a way that he knew how to get them to give the best performance they could in that moment. Because there's nothing, there are plenty of roles here where I'm like, you know, Ben-Hur's little sister, she's not an award-winning actress, but she gives what that scene needs. So he's a director who very obviously communicates very clearly with his crew and his talent. Because they know what they're supposed to be doing. There's no question here. None of the blocking appears confused. None of the interactions appear hesitant. It's literally something where somebody came in and said, okay, here's what we're going to do, guys. You know, you good with this? And it works. And when you know that on a scale like this, how difficult that has to be to coordinate, I mean, I'm not the least bit surprised that this won 11 Oscars at this point, because simply the technical wizardry on display here is impressive. And then when you add on the fact that it's done by a guy who didn't typically do big epics like this, I mean, holy cow. Like, he really made the most of the opportunity.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, I mentioned one of his movies that he did before this, Roman Holiday, which is one of my favorites, with Audrey Hepburn, which is her debut in a starring role. And, you know, he became known as a actor's director. And I think that you can really see that with all of the lead performances here, especially with, you know, Heston and Hawkins and Boyd. They are giving their best performances. I think even Harriet, who's playing Esther, gives a great performance, you know, and her chemistry there with Heston and all that. He's really doing what this movie needs, which is, as big as it is, you actually have to care about the characters to care about the rest of the stuff that's happening, right? Doesn't matter how big a movie is. If you don't care about what a character is going through in that scene, okay, whatever, you know, you can have, you know, it'd be like getting to the portal scene on Avengers Endgame and not actually caring about any of these characters, right? Like you have to have an emotional investment to have everything else matter. And so I think that's what he's able to do and what he really brings to the role as director of this film specifically.
And what really needs to be underlined as well is, you know, you mentioned Avengers Endgame. How much of Avengers Endgame investment is because of how many other films were used to get you to that point?
Sure.
Whereas he gets you to care just within the context of a single work, that's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of these movies, John, they are big, and so are their scores. You've got Miklos Rozsa, I think is how you say his name, doing the score here. And I wanted to ask you how you felt like the music helped. Does it help bring this movie to life? Does it detract in any way from this movie? What did you end up thinking of the score?
I thought the score was great. I did. It's what this type of film demands, which is it's big, it's melodramatic, it swells, it's got the cues. Could I hum anything from it? No, it's not a Star Wars score. It's not Indiana Jones. It's not James Horner with Aliens or Star Trek II, which are basically the same score, but you know. And like you have a score, though, where somebody were to put it on, I'd be like, is that Ben-Hur? And I think that, you know, while we sit there and we talk about the 3.5 hours thing, you know, I honestly think there's something missing from the world that we don't have the overture and the, you know, the act break music. I think there's something missing from that. How fun would it be to watch a film now that has that, that has an overture and act break music halfway through? Like that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, maybe just do that with Avengers Doomsday since it's going to be 47 hours.
Only? Oh, they cut it back. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. No, I think that, I think it's a great score. I think it's what the film needs as a score. Works for me.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think he does a great job. I think one of the keys is to be able I feel like he's able to kind of tie in enough to a slightly Middle Eastern feel and mm-hmm. sound without being stereotypical and still be this big Hollywood score. So, I think he does a really good job with it. And I've got the full score, and I'll turn it on every once in a while when I'm going to be working for a while on the computer. It's really enjoyable. And, of course, you know, you as you talk about, you've got the overture, you know, you can mm-hmm. listen to there at the beginning, and it's fantastic. It reminds me of, the Star Trek The Motion Picture overture. Right. You know, just gorgeous mm-hmm. stuff. So I wanted to ask you in the end, what do you feel like the legacy of Ben-Hur is? You know, we've talked a little bit about that with the way it influenced Lucas, the way it's influenced a lot of other filmmakers. But now having seen it, do you think like that this truly is one of those movies that was just pivotal to filmmaking in the way that it would change everything that came after it?
Yeah. I can clearly see that there nothing's the same afterward. The Ten Commandments is an achievement. I would argue that Ben-Hur proves it's something that can be done again and even better. And in terms of technical achievement, I think it's amazing. Like this is one of those ones where there are films that come out, and after they come out, you go, it's never going to be the same again. I mean, 11 Oscars was a record held until Titanic. Nobody ever even approached it until Titanic. And even you look at Titanic, and Titanic is the same sort of thing. Everything changed afterward. Because the way it was produced, the quality of what was on screen, the fact that it was a long epic that kept people engaged and cared, the fact that the score worked so well, like there are so many things, and the actors that they cast, you can't really see anybody else in those roles. And you wind up seeing, yeah, this is another pivot point. Star Wars is a pivot point. In the 60s, you have plenty, you know, the 60s come and go. You know, there are a couple of points there. But, like, yeah, you have this as, this is a definite demarcation line for film. And I can't sing enough praises about that chariot race. I was so legitimately floored by how good it was. It was stunning to me. Simply the construction of that chariot race alone blows my mind, because I knew the sense of place. I knew where I was in the race. I knew it cut the right amount of times. It had the right amount of close-ups. There were enough moments that were cut so well that I had to go, oh, somebody had to get hurt there. And then I have to do some research. I'm like, all right, I need some background here. And for anybody listening who, like me, thought somebody died during the making of this, that is not true. And I also looked back because I was very concerned. According to the great Wikipedia, which must never be challenged, apparently no horses were hurt during that chariot race either, which I consider
which is absolute, stunning.
I can't believe there was literally at one point where I was like, oh no. Like, I was legitimately concerned. I had to go look up, did any horses die during the making? And they did not. So I can watch it again as a result, because I wouldn't be able to watch it if I knew that a horse had died during it. So, but yeah, I mean, good grief. It's, you know, what a, yeah, everything's different. There's a reason it's in, you know, the National Film Registry.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and I think, and I like what you said, you knew you were comparing it to all these other movies, right, that end up doing the same thing. And the way I think that they do that, right, is by seeing something that's missing, right? You know, MGM is trying to save itself, but I think it rightly discerns what was actually missing to make it such a huge hit then with audiences, right? In the same way that, you know, Lucas pinpoints what's missing in the late 70s cinema and it becomes a massive hit. You know, the same way, you know, Spielberg did with Jaws, the same way, like you mentioned, with Cameron, with Titanic, or even the original Avatar, right, which became such a massive hit because, again, it was giving people things they'd never seen before, you know? And I think this is one of the things when I think of the legacy of this movie, what it is that taking big swings means being able to learn the right lessons and then translate that into a film. And as you know, you and I have been, you know, podcasting for years now. I think what we've seen so many times is that a lot of studios take the wrong lessons from films and then try to translate that into the next film, and it actually is such a detriment. I mean, we could just look at the whole DCEU as a way in which studios took the wrong lessons from those things and then did the wrong things with them and turned something that people were really getting behind into something that they didn't want to get behind, you know? And so I think that's the legacy of this, is like a studio taking a huge swing, but they had taken the right lesson, which is that people wanted to see something that they'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And they couldn't see on, and you couldn't do on television in a way that you can't, you know. And I was talking to somebody last night, a younger guy, and he's like, man, I haven't been to the movies in years. He's like, I got a 65-inch TV at home. It's the same. And I was like, but it's not the same. You don't have a Dolby Cinema screen with sound that is literally shaking the entire room as you're bursting through space, or you know, you're watching. You know, my wife and I saw Michael in Dolby Cinema this last week. You know, and the concert, it feels like it's a part of you because of the way in which the sound is reverberating through you, which is so obviously so important in music, right? And like you. Or we saw Project Hail Mary in that same theater, you know, and those intense moments of action where you're like, oh, is he going to make it back into the spaceship? You know, with it just looks like he's gonna, you can't get that. And so anyway, all that to say, I hope that studios is we're in a place where, you know, actually movie theaters are up this year. More people are going to the theater. And a big part of that is people going for films that they can't see at home, right? Yep. And don't feel the same at home. So hopefully it'll continue to be a big year. But John, it is your first time to see Ben-Hur, which means that your rating is going to be really important. So how many chariot races are you giving Ben-Hur?
First and foremost, I'm going to say this is one of those films that transcends rating.
And what Agreed.
I mean, what I mean by that
it's
is
just not fair.
It does. Well, it just doesn't matter. Right.
It's like, true. It's like, yeah,
even if I were to have hated this film, I would still say somebody has to go out and see it at least once. There is so much in this that you need to see to understand film that it transcends in the sense that it doesn't matter whether you like it. It's an intellectual exercise at a minimum. But the fact that it's enjoyable is a massive plus. I think that I will give it a 5 because I can't see a way around giving it a 5. Because on a micro level, I could go in and I could nitpick this or I could nitpick that or I could pick apart this performance or I could take this thing down or I could say that didn't work particularly well. Yes, but the story of any piece of art is how it comes together as a whole. You don't criticize a painting based on the fact that you might have done a different brush stroke somewhere. You look at the painting, and looking at this as a complete work, it's a 5. I mean, I have to give it a 5. Again, I'll go back to it again. Just the chariot race alone. The march up to the emperor, the sea battle. There's so much happening here that's so perfect that I don't see any way other than to give it a 5. So that's where I land with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it so rightly that this is one of those movies that just kind of defies ratings. And I do think that, as we were talking about with the idea of the legacy of this film, is it because it's a movie that changed cinema forever, you know, and what people thought of what a movie could be, you know. And so, therefore, it just deserves a 5 on those merits. But one of the things that I found fascinating about this, John, is I've seen this movie before. And like anybody these days, I can be tempted to play on my phone while I'm watching a movie. The only time I really looked at my phone during this 3.5-hour film is when the intermission came on and I was like, oh, it's a perfect time to go to the bathroom. And I pick up my phone to see if I got any messages. But other than that, I was just glued to the screen and I was surprised at how well this movie was keeping me engaged, even though I've seen it before.
Right.
And that's a 5. And like we talked about, you know, and you say many times on you've said here or in House Lights or other places and Aggressive Negotiations together that sometimes the parts can be greater than the whole. But I think this is one of those movies where it's like the whole is greater than the whole.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. It's like everything ends up coming together in a way to make this what it is. And there's a reason that it's not just an epic in the sense of like, the genre, the movie is just epic, you know? And yeah, there are very few films since then that have just been able to really pull off that style of epic and pull it off. And so, yeah, 5 chariot races for me. So, John, if people wanted to, you know, get a chance to catch up with you, talk more about Ben-Hur, see what else that you're doing these days, other podcasts and all that, where would they be able to look you up?
Well, gosh, you can find me online as Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. The two social networks I spend the most amount of time on are Goodreads and Letterboxd, because I love talking about books and movies. Hence why I came by here to the 602 Club, as I love talking about film. And you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network, where I co-host the aforementioned House Lights with Darren Moser and Tristan Riddell. We have a time there. And you can, of course, find me over on Aggressive Negotiations, also on the Nerd Party Network, which I co-host with you, Mr. Matthew Rushing.
I'm glad you're over on House Lights telling the guys what's up with Kurosawa, finally.
I'm trying my best.
I love just watching, you know, and I can actually hear it and see it playing, and as we listen to every episode, the tail that's tucked so firmly between Tristan's legs, you know, because, you know, he hasn't watched any Kurosawa films up until now. So I really love that, but I appreciate you doing that for me. But of course, you could find me all over social media under the name Matt Rushingzer 2. I'm here on the network, of course, outside the 602 Club with such great Star Trek talk with my good friend, Chris Jones. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network outside of Aggressive Negotiations with Owlpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. But as always, thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now, you hear?